Chapter 31. Our government is oddly inconsistent in this matter of official dress. When its representative is a civilian who has not been a soliter, it restricts him to the black swallowtail and white tie. But if he is a civilian who has been a soliter, it allows him to wear the uniform of his former rank as an official dress. When General Sickles was minister to Spain, he always wore, when on official duty, the dress uniform of a major general. When General Grant visited foreign courts, he went handsomely and properly ablaze in the uniform of a full general, and was introduced by diplomatic survivals of his own presidential administration. The latter, by official necessity, went in the meek and lowly swallowtail, a deliciously sarcastic contrast. The one dress representing the honest and honorable dignity of the nation, the other, the cheap hypocrisy of the Republican simplicity tradition. In Paris, our present representative can perform his official functions reputably clothed, for he was an officer in the Civil War. In London, our late ambassador was similarly situated, for he, also, was an officer in the Civil War. But Mr. Choate must represent the great republic even at official breakfasts at 7, in the morning, in that same old funny swallow tail. Our government's notions about proprieties of costume are indeed very, very odd, as suggested by that last fact. The swallow tail is recognized the world over as not wearable in the daytime. It is a night dress, and a night dress only, a night shirt is not more so. Yet, when our representative makes an official visit in the morning, he is obliged by his government to go in that night dress. It makes the very cab horses laugh. The truth is, that for a while during the present century, and up to something short of 40 years ago, we had a lucid interval, and dropped the Republican simplicity sham, and dressed our foreign representatives in a handsome and becoming official costume. This was discarded by and by, and the swallow tail substituted. I believe it is not now known which statesman brought about this change, but we all know that, stupid as he was as to diplomatic proprieties in dress, he would not have sent his daughter to a state ball in a corn-shucking costume, nor to a corn-shucking in a state ball costume, to be harshly criticized as an ill-mannered offender against the proprieties of custom in both places. And we know another thing, viz., that he himself would not have wounded the tastes and feelings of a family of mourners by attending a funeral in their house in a costume which was an offense against the dignities and decorum prescribed by tradition and sanctified by custom. Yet that man was so heedless as not to reflect that all the social customs of civilized peoples are entitled to respectful observance, and that no man with a right spirit of courtesy in him ever has any disposition to transgress these customs. There is still another argument for a rational diplomatic dress, a business argument. We are a trading nation, and our representative is a business agent. If he is respected, esteemed, and liked where he is stationed, he can exercise an influence which can extend our trade and forward our prosperity. A considerable number of his business activities have their field in his social relations, and clothes which do not offend against local manners and customers and prejudices are a valuable part of his equipment in this matter would be, if Franklin had died earlier. I have not done with gratis suggestions yet. We made a great deal of valuable advance when we instituted the office of ambassador. That lofty rank endows its possessor with several times as much influence, consideration, and effectiveness as the rank of minister bestows. For the sake of the country's dignity and for the sake of her advantage commercially, we should have ambassadors, not ministers, at the great courts of the world. But not at present salaries. No, if we are to maintain present salaries, let us make no more ambassadors, and let us unmake those we have already made. The great position, without the means of respectably maintaining it, there could be no wisdom in that. A foreign representative, to be valuable to his country, must be on good terms with the officials of the capital, and with the rest of the influential folk. He must mingle with this society, He cannot sit at home, it is not business, it butters no commercial parsnips. He must attend the dinners, banquets, suppers, balls, receptions, and must return these hospitalities. He should return as good as he gets to, for the sake of the dignity of his country, and for the sake of business. Have we ever had a minister or an ambassador who could do this on his salary? No, not once, from Franklin's time to ours. Other countries understand the commercial value of properly lining the pockets of their representatives, but apparently our government has not learned it. England is the most successful trader of the several trading nations, and she takes good care of the watchmen who keep guard in her commercial towers. It has been a long time now since we needed to blush for our representatives abroad. It has become custom to send our fittest. We send men of distinction, cultivation, character, our ablest, our choicest, our best. Then we cripple their efficiency through the meagerness of their pay. Here is a list of salaries for English and American ministers and ambassadors. City salaries, American English, Paris $17, $545,000, Berlin $17, $540,000, Vienna $12, $40,000, Constantinople $10, $40,000, St. Petersburg $17, $539,000, Rome $12, $35,000, Washington $32, $500. Sir Julian Pauncefoot, the English ambassador at Washington, has a very fine house besides at no damage to his salary. English ambassadors pay no house rent, they live in palaces owned by England. Our representatives pay house rent out of their salaries. You can judge by the above figures what kind of houses the United States of America has been used to living in abroad, and what sort of return-entertaining he has done. There is not a salary in our list which would properly house the representative receiving it, and, in addition, pay $3,000 toward his family's bacon and donuts, the strange but economical and customary fare of the American ambassador's household, except on Sundays, when petrified Boston crackers are added. The ambassadors and ministers of foreign nations not only have generous salaries, but their governments provide them with money wherewith to pay a considerable part of their hospitality bills. I believe our government pays no hospitality bills except those incurred by the Navy. Through this concession to the Navy, that arm is able to do us credit in foreign parts, and certainly that is well and politic. But why the government does not think it well and politic that our diplomats should be able to do us like credit abroad is one of those mysterious inconsistencies which have been puzzling me ever since I stopped trying to understand baseball and took up statesmanship as a pastime. To return to the matter of house rent, good houses, properly furnished, in European capitals, are not to be had at small figures. Consequently, our foreign representatives have been accustomed to live in garrets, sometimes on the roof. Being poor men, it has been the best they could do on the salary which the government has paid them. How could they adequately return the hospitalities shown them? It was impossible. It would have exhausted the salary in 3 months. Still, it was their official duty to entertain their influentials after some sort of fashion, and they did the best they could with their limited purse. In return for champagne they furnished lemonade. In return for game they furnished ham. In return for whale they furnished sardines. In return for liquors they furnished condensed milk. In return for the battalion of liveried and powdered flunkies they furnished the hired girl. In return for the fairy wilderness of sumptuous decorations they draped the stove with the American flag. In return for the orchestra they furnished zither and ballads by the family. In return for the ball, but they didn't return the ball, except in cases where the United States lived on the roof and had room. Is this an exaggeration? It can hardly be called that. I saw nearly the equivalent of it a good many years ago. A minister was trying to create influential friends for a project which might be worth 10 millions a year to the agriculturists of the Republic, and our government had furnished him ham and lemonade to persuade the opposition with. The minister did not succeed. He might not have succeeded if his salary had been what it ought to have been, $50,000 or $60,000 a year, but his chances would have been very greatly improved. And in any case, he and his dinners and his country would not have been joked about by the hard-hearted and pitied by the compassionate. Any experienced drummer will testify that, when you want to do business, there is no economy in ham and lemonade. The drummer takes his country customer to the theater, the opera, the circus, dines him, wines him, entertains him all the day and all the night in luxurious style, and plays upon his human nature in all seductive ways. For he knows, by old experience, that this is the best way to get a profitable order out of him. He has this reward. All governments except our own play the same policy, with the same end in view, and they, also, have their reward. But ours refuses to do business by business ways, and sticks to ham and lemonade. This is the most expensive diet known to the diplomatic service of the world. Ours is the only country of first importance that pays its foreign representatives trifling salaries. If we were poor, we could not find great fault with these economies. Perhaps at least one could find a sort of plausible excuse for them. But we are not poor, and the excuse fails. As shown above, some of our important diplomatic representatives receive $12,000, others, $17,500. These salaries are all ham and lemonade, and unworthy of the flag. When we have a rich ambassador in London or Paris, he lives as the ambassador of a country like ours ought to live, and it costs him $100,000 a year to do it. But why should we allow him to pay that out of his private pocket? There is nothing fair about it, and the Republic is no proper subject for anyone's charity. In several cases our salaries of $12,000 should be $50,000, and all of the salaries of $17,500 ought to be $75,000 or $100,000, since we pay no representative's house rent. Our State Department realizes the mistake which we are making, and would like to rectify it, but it has not the power. When a young girl reaches 18, she is recognized as being a woman. She adds 6 inches to her skirt, she unplaits her dangling braids and balls her hair on top of her head, she stops sleeping with her little sister, and has a room to herself, and becomes in many ways a thundering expense. But she is in society now, and Papa has to stand it. There is no avoiding it. Very well. The great Republic lengthened her skirts last year, balled up her hair, and entered the world society. This means that, if she would prosper and stand fair with society, she must put aside some of her dearest and darlingest young ways and superstitions, and do as society does. Of course, she can decline, if she wants to, but this would be unwise. She ought to realize, now that she has come out, that this is a right and proper time to change a part of her style. She is in Rome, and it has long been granted that when one is in Rome it is good policy to do as Rome does. To advantage Rome? No, to advantage herself. If our government has really paid representatives of ours on the Paris Commission $100,000 apiece for 6 weeks' work, I feel sure that it is the best cash investment the nation has made in many years. For it seems quite impossible that, with that precedent on the books, the government will be able to find excuses for continuing its diplomatic salaries at the present mean figure. P.S.S. Vienna, January 10. I see, by this morning's telegraphic news, that I am not to be the new ambassador here, after all. I hardly know what to say. I do not care anything about it, but it is at least a surprise. I have for many months been using my influence at Washington to get this diplomatic see expanded into an ambassadorship, with the idea, of course, th, but never mind. Let it go. It is of no consequence. I say it calmly, for I am calm. But at the same time, however, the subject has no interest for me, and never had. I never really intended to take the place, anyway I made up my mind to it months and months ago, nearly a year. But now, while I am calm, I would like to say this, that so long as I shall continue to possess an American's proper pride in the honor and dignity of his country, I will not take any ambassadorship in the gift of the flag at a salary short of $75,000 a year. If I shall be charged with wanting to live beyond my country's means, I cannot help it. A country which cannot afford ambassadors' wages should be ashamed to have ambassadors. Think of a $17,500 ambassador, particularly for America. Why, it is the most ludicrous spectacle, the most inconsistent and incongruous spectacle, contrivable by even the most diseased imagination. It is a billionaire in a paper collar, a king in a breech clout, an archangel in a tin halo. And, for pure sham and hypocrisy, the salary is just the match of the ambassador's official clothes, that boastful advertisement of a Republican simplicity which manifests itself at home in $50,000 salaries to insurance presidents and railway lawyers, and in domestic palaces whose fittings and furnishings often transcend in costly display and splendor and richness the fittings and furnishings of the palaces of the sceptered masters of Europe, and which has invented and exported to the old world the palace car, the sleeping car, the tram car, the electric trolley, the best bicycles, the best motor cars, the steam heater, the best and smartest systems of electric calls, and telephonic aids to laziness and comfort, the elevator, the private bathroom, hot and cold water on tap, the palace hotel, with its multifarious conveniences, comforts, shows, and luxuries, the list is interminable. In a word, Republican simplicity found Europe with one shirt on her back, so to speak, as far as real luxuries, conveniences, and the comforts of life go, and has clothed her to the chin with the latter. We are the lavishest and showiest, and most luxury-loving people on the earth. And at our masthead we fly one true and honest symbol, the gaudiest flag the world has ever seen. Oh, Republican simplicity, there are many, many humbugs in the world, but none to which you need take off your hat. Look, note. This is not a fancy sketch. I got it from a clergyman who was an instructor at Woolwich 40 years ago, and who vouched for its truth. It was at a banquet in London in honor of one of the two or three conspicuously illustrious English military names of this generation. For reasons which will presently appear, I will withhold his real name and titles, and call him Lieutenant General Lord Arthur Scoresby, V.C.C., K.C.C., B., etc., etc., etc. What a fascination there is in a renowned name! There say the man, in actual flesh, whom I had heard of, so many thousands of times since that day, 30 years before, when his name shot suddenly to the zenith from a Crimean battlefield, to remain forever celebrated. It was food and drink to me to look, and look, and look at that demigod. Scanning, searching, noting. The quietness, the reserve, the noble gravity of his countenance. The simple honesty that expressed itself all over him, the sweet unconsciousness of his greatness, unconsciousness of the hundreds of admiring eyes fastened upon him, unconsciousness of the deep, loving, sincere worship welling out of the breasts of those people and flowing toward him. The clergyman at my left was an old acquaintance of mine, clergyman now, but had spent the first half of his life in the camp and field, and as an instructor in the military school at Woolwich. Just at the moment I have been talking about, a veiled and singular light glimmered in his eyes, and he leaned down and muttered confidentially to me, indicating the hero of the banquet with a gesture. Privately, his glory is an accident, just a product of incredible luck. ... This verdict was a great surprise to me. If its subject had been Napoleon, or Socrates, or Solomon, my astonishment could not have been greater. Some days later came the explanation of this strange remark, and this is what the Reverend told me. About 40 years ago I was an instructor in the military academy at Woolwich. I was present in one of the sections when young Scoresby underwent his preliminary examination. I was touched to the quick with pity, for the rest of the class answered uprightly and handsomely, while he didn't know anything, so to speak. He was evidently good, and sweet, and lovable, and guileless, and so it was exceedingly painful to see him stand there, as serene as a graven image, and deliver himself of answers which were veritably miraculous for Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.